Okay, folks, let's reconvey. So if we could have our next speaker ready. And as a reminder, I would like to make sure that all of my colleagues here fill out the little yellow sheet. So Mr. Young, you reminded me I needed to be.
Thank you.
So please go ahead.
And it's going to be a hard act to follow, but we're going to try. Myself and my esteemed colleagues, Kirstein Wasson and Brent Hughes, are going to be giving you guys a little perspective of the water quality data that we have and some of the research that we've been doing that's come out of the water quality data. Some of you have already heard this, so I apologize for repeating, but some of you haven't, so we'll just go through it real quick. First, I'm going to go through just what programs we have at the SLU, water quality-wise, and then what we've learned from that, kind of the effects of these nutrient loadings into the estuary. Kirstein and Brent are going to talk a little bit about that. So first, at Elkhorn SLU, we have two major water quality programs. One is what we call the volunteer monitoring program. We actually have one of the volunteers here in the audience. And the volunteer water quality program has been going on since 1989. We cover a lot of the watershed of the SLU with these about 24 sites. And we collect nutrients and water quality parameters, temperature and physical parameters. This is kind of another map of just showing, we tried to group some of the sites, so into the kind of upper estuary sites up here, the reserve sites, lower estuary, and Tumbladero and Salinas River sites. The second part of the data set that we have is part of the NER program, the National Estuarine Research Reserve program, where we have just four sites, but these are collecting every 15 minutes. And two of those sites go back to 1995. So we have a tremendous temporal coverage of some specific areas in the SLU. And in 2001, we started doing nutrient monitoring at those sites also. We also have a weather station that we can tie in some of the data with. So the Elkhorn SLU is a part of the National Estuarine Research Reserve systems. We have sister reserves all across the country. Most of them are on the East Coast. But they're all doing these same monitoring program, the NER monitoring program. So these reserves have these four sites that are collecting every 15 minutes. So let's go into some examples of some of the data, some of the trends that we're seeing. And I just picked nitrate. We have all kinds of, we have nitrate, phosphate, ammonia, but I just picked nitrate here to show from 1989. These are annual averages. The top graph is the reserve sites, and the bottom graph is Tumbladero. I just chose these two to kind of two drastically different areas in the same water system. First to note that those reserve sites are only going up to 5 milligrams. These are all in milligrams per liter. And the lower graph, the Tumbladero SLU, is going all the way up to 60 milligrams per liter. Another thing to note is something that we'd love to try to look into more. You see some trends, a little bit of trends. There's no direct trend of, you know, a decreasing or an increasing trend, but you do see some periods of elevated concentrations, periods of lower concentrations, but they're not the same in the reserve as in the Tembladero. And so we'd really like to try to figure that out. I'll go into later that we're trying to now do, these are just concentrations, but we're looking into trying to get a current meter out so we can actually get it at some of the loads that are coming in. This is a graph showing some of the NER data, that 15-minute data at one of our sites at Azevedo, two sites, contrasting two sites, Azevedo Pond and South Marsh. Azevedo's in red. It's a behind a tide gate. We have much of the slough is behind tide gates, and this creates a lot of water quality problems. And this is just one example of this hyperventilating that happens in some of these areas. This is dissolved oxygen going on a daily basis, super saturated to almost hypoxic, but down at almost zero, contrasted with the South Marsh site that is a fully tidal site that's getting flushing, daily flushing, that full tidal flushing, and the dissolved oxygen is much, much more stable. So wanted to highlight one example of some water quality improvement that actually was as a result of some restoration that occurred in the slough. This was a paper that we actually put out a couple years ago focusing on a site in the upper estuary, again, that Azevedo Pond site, where in this area in the past there was no buffer of any sort. This was a picture in the when there's actually water flowing and rain, and you can see the furlows going right into the water. The restoration took those out and created a buffer around. And so we looked at the data and tried to see, you know, well, could we see any water quality improvements that happen as a result? There was also some upland of that watershed, that micro watershed. There was some management changes that happened upland. And this is just one example of the ammonia concentrations. That green line is showing kind of when that restoration occurred. Mm-hmm. And you see before there's much more higher concentrations, and after these much lower concentrations. So restoration does have an effect. We wanted to show at least something positive. So the nutrient sources and loads, some of the new perspectives that are coming out. Again, this ties in real well with Andrea's talk, with the watersheds being linked together. So I'm just walking you through here it's not just the Elkhorn watershed when we're talking about water quality in Elkhorn Slough. There's multiple watersheds that are coming into play, that are coming into the slough itself, and the high tide pushing that water. Water is coming down from the Tembladero, Morro Coho, Gabalon watersheds, and the Salinas River watershed. So there's another thing to note here is that the brown is the farmland, and the red is the cities. So there's a big amount of water coming into the slough that's not just our local watershed. And so I mentioned that we're trying to start getting a handle on, because we've learned recently that is a significant source, that source of water coming down the Tembladero and coming into the harbor and then getting pushed up the slough is a real significant source of nutrients. And so we're trying to get a handle on putting a current meter out in the Tembladero slough to get a handle of flow. We already have concentrations, so we can get a much better handle on the loads of nutrients. So you're looking at a graph of the daily discharge, and we've put on there Temblodero Slough. We also have one in the Old Salinas River Channel. So that pink is the Old Salinas River Channel. The blue is the Temblodero Slough. And the green is a USGS data from the reclamation ditch. And so we're trying to, actually we have a small grant to get that going out and for the next couple of years to hopefully be able to get a much better understanding of how much water is coming in. And hopefully be able to learn why we get these periodic elevated concentrations. And so with that, I think I'm gonna pass it on to Brent, and he's gonna talk a bit about nutrient loading in the estuary.
Thanks, John. My name is Brent Hughes, and I'm a researcher at the Elkhorn Slough Reserve as well as a PhD student at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And I would like to thank you all for giving us the opportunity to speak on water quality issues in Elkhorn Slough. So part of what John was leading into are the fact that Elkhorn Slough is highly nutrient enriched. And I'm here to talk to you somewhat about the ecological effects. And so, and you guys earlier had mentioned beneficial uses. This really touches on what are the impairments to the beneficial uses of Elkhorn Slough. And to put this in a historical perspective as well, this kind of links Andrew, what Andrea was just talking to you about, as well as John. There's been fundamental changes to the landscape surrounding Elkhorn Slough. And if you can look at this figure here, this is fertilizer sales in black, these little black dots from the last 80 or 90 years. And you can see that fertilizer sales in Monterey County have increased tremendously. These blue squares here are nitrate, and this is on a log scale. This is the first point was taken around 1928, and there were some various studies in the 1970s, and then more recently, this is all the Elkhorn Slough Reserve data. These points were taken at the very exact same spot in the estuary, right near the Highway 1 bridge. And what you can see is an exponential increase in nitrate over time. And so when you look at this, you say, wow, that's quite impressive. And when I look at this, I see, as an ecologist, I see a system that's under tremendous amounts of stress. And some of the ecological data that we are collecting really reflects the stress in the system.
I'd like a clarification on that previous slide.
Yeah.
Between 1975, each little square represents a sample?
Yes, that's correct.
So you're saying that there were 1, 2, 3, maybe a half a dozen sample in 75, but in 1990 there were 10 times.
These are all monthly samples. So from the period of between 1970 and 1971, just because of the scale of the figure, between 1970 and 1971, there was about 16 samples taken. Between 1974 and 1976, there was roughly 20 or so. 1928, there was about 4 to 6 samples taken. And then since then, 1988, it was when the program started in Elkhorn Slough, and those samples are taken monthly. So these are all monthly samples. And so the 1970s, you have roughly about a 3 to 4 year period of sample collection. Okay, and so we're just starting to publish a lot of these results on the ecological effects. This is a paper that we put out a couple of years ago and this is really important because we really had to figure out, well, how impaired is the system? And so this paper really looked at how impaired the system is. And just to point out that a lot of the research from this paper from that restoration project John was just talking to you about the benefits of restoration, as well as the some of the monitoring we're doing was actually funded by the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board. So just to highlight that for you all. Okay, so first and foremost, what happens when you get excessive nutrients into these coastal systems? You get algal blooms. And one thing that characterizes Elkhorn Slough are these macroalgal blooms that form, and they're pretty much consistent persistent all year long. They really start peaking in the summertime. So these data points are means from mega plots, mega sampling plots. They're 1 hectare plots that are scattered around the estuary. And so what you can see is that, and this is the intertidal. So these are intertidal mudflats. And what you can see is that in the summertime, we get these very consistent blooms where nearly the entire estuary is carpeted in macroalgae. And likewise, in these areas, we were just talking about areas behind water control structures. Areas behind water control structures get these things, these floating algal mats, which are really bad for the system. This is data taken from this exact same spot, which is right behind the, it's Morro Coho Slough, it's right behind the Whole Enchilada restaurant. If you're a graduate student, it's right behind Phil's Snack Shack, because Phil's Snack Shack's a lot cheaper. But what you can see is that just like the intertidal algae, and in these areas where you have tidal restriction, you get these really strong peaks of these floating algal mats. And these are really harmful because they don't have anywhere to go but down when they eventually die. And this causes a great deal of water quality issues. And it impairs the habitat quality for aquatic organisms. So what we've done in our studies, in our initial eutrophication study, was to take several indicators of eutrophication, which include macroalgal mats, phytoplankton blooms, hypoxia events, unionized ammonia concentrations, and sediment quality, to map out the level of eutrophication in the estuary. And just to point out, this is what it looks like. In yellow, most of the estuary is yellow. Yellow is not good. It indicates that the system is impaired and it has moderate eutrophication. Green is good. And the only place you see green is right around the mouth of the estuary, where it gets flushed out by the Pacific Ocean water. And then when you get in further up into the estuary, I know the color might not be so great on your screens, but it starts turning orange. And then what I really want to point out as well is that behind these bold black lines are areas, water bodies behind water control structures. And that's when you get really significant impairments. In fact, we had to create our own category for these called hyper-eutrophication. And one of the consequences of this eutrophication is that you get hypoxia. And in some areas of the Elkhorn Slough, you get severe hypoxia. Especially around these water control structures. This is just a figure of various stations where we collect water quality. And we put the daily maximum daily tidal range. So this is just indicates how much water is being exchanged. These black dots represent areas behind water control structures. And so what you can see is that as you restrict tidal range more and more, you start getting more hypoxic conditions, which is also bad for aquatic life. So now I'm going to move into some specific species that are indicators of poor water quality. And they're also usually really important, either from an ecological perspective or from an economic perspective. And so one of the primary canaries in the coal mine for poor water quality is seagrass. And on our coast here, we have a plant called Zoster marina, which is, the common name is eelgrass. And what you see in this figure is the cover of eelgrass in the estuary from 1930 to present. And so what you see in 1930 is what we probably would consider a baseline condition. And once fertilizer sales started really ramping up in Monterey County, we saw a significant decline in eelgrass. And eelgrass is really sensitive to nutrients in the system and as well as algae, that this ephemeral weedy algae that grows, because it ends up competing with the eelgrass. And so during the 1930s and up into the 1950s, there was a significant decline in eelgrass, almost to the point of extinction. And then there was a period of resilience. And this period of resilience happened right after the opening of the Moss Landing Harbor. So it was, water was being exchanged at a greater rate, and it caused flushing. We are imagining at this point was some sort of equilibrium point until eutrophication started happening again, and you started getting declines in seagrass. Right around the 80s, the seagrass was almost completely wiped out. There's just several patches left over. And then since then, there's been a period of resilience that actually coincides with the return of sea otters to the system, and that's a story for another day. But what I want to point out, really, is that the eelgrass shows these tremendous fluctuations in a system that's somewhat stable. You would have seagrass that is kind of more like a flat line. Here we have these huge fluctuations, and it really indicates a system that is kind of spiraling out of control. Now, one of the reasons why you don't want to lose the eelgrass in a system is because it does really important things. It provides habitat for many important species. It filters out contaminants. It provides shoreline protection. And so when you lose that in favor of macroalgae, ephemeral macroalgae, you lose a lot of the important functions of that system. Okay, now I'm just going to talk to you somewhat about fish, and specifically flatfish. And one thing we know about Elkhorn Slough is that it's a really important nursery regionally for flatfish, especially some of the flatfish species that we care about that have economic, commercial, and recreational importance, such as California halibut, English sole, and sand dabs. And so this is data collected over the last 25 years that combines the water quality data that we've been collecting, which is dissolved oxygen, and fish surveys that have been done in the estuary for decades. And what you see is that consistently, the lower the oxygen goes, the probability of finding one of these flatfish in the estuary decreases significantly. And we see this for several types of surveys. So there's otter trawls, which are nets that are towed behind a boat in the channels, in the subtidal channels. And you have beach seines, which are performed are nets that are dragged over the mud flats. And so this just indicates that if you get these poor dissolved oxygen or hypoxic conditions, you start losing these important flatfish species. And so we can take these probabilities and actually map them, just like we did eutrophication. So each one of these each one of these kind of color spectrums represents the probability, where green is really good, and then red is getting worse, almost to where you don't find any flatfish species. And the really important thing that we are able to demonstrate with this mapping exercise is that where we find really poor water quality conditions, you don't find flatfish. And so what this shows is that, especially behind these water control structures and some of the more tightly restricted areas, is that if you start losing if you start generating poor water quality, this has consequences for the overall habitat available for these flatfish species. And then lastly, we can actually, because we know that Elkhorn Slough is this really important nursery, meaning that juvenile species will actually move into the estuary, use it as grounds to grow and become adults, and then move offshore, and that's where they're caught. And so this is data from English sole, which is one of those flatfish species, and it's caught offshore. These are from the National Marine Fisheries Service, so these are standardized trawls, And what I want to point out to you is that right here is English sole caught a year after extreme hypoxia in Elkhorn Slough. And then the gray graph right next to it, the gray bar, is English sole caught after normoxic events, so after a good dissolved oxygen year. And what you can see is that there's about a threefold increase in the amount of English sole available. And so the rest of these figures are just controls to show here's a wrecked sole. This is an analogous species that does not use the estuary as its nursery grounds. And you can see that the dissolved oxygen condition in the estuary has no effect on that, as well as Half Moon Bay, which is an area that is removed from the Monterey Bay population and doesn't really have an estuary that serves as a nursery or has hypoxic conditions. And then lastly, and this is the last slide, this is the last figure I'm going to show you, this is actually fish landing data from Monterey Bay as a function of the number of hypoxic months in the estuary a year prior. And what you can see is that there's actually significant there's a significant negative correlation with the amount of hypoxia we get in the estuary and actually the amount of English sole that's caught in Monterey Bay. So now we're showing how what happens on land affects this really important nearshore environment that ultimately can affect the offshore environment as well. And so that will now transition to Kirsten, who will talk to you more about these species.
Question, kind of clarification if I could, Mr. Chair. Brent, can you correlate your colorized map with levels of nitrogen? You know, the one that has the...
Right. No, we can't. And the reason being is because there's so many nutrients in the system that it kind of, you don't have this kind of nice response. So we're talking about now decades of nutrient loading. A lot of the nutrients are actually locked in the sediments. Mm. So there's been discussion on this between us and some other researchers like Ken Johnson at Mbari and some quick kind of back of the envelope modeling calculations shows us that if you cut off the nutrient faucet to Elkhorn Slough, there would still be eutrophication for decades to come just because of all the nutrients locked in the sediments. So because of that, we don't see these really tight correlations with nutrients and biological indicators. Mm-hmm. And it's because there's all these, I didn't get into this, but there's all these what are called filters. And like an environmental filter would be tidal flushing. So if you get tidal flushing, that's why areas near the mouth, although super high nutrients, mm-hmm. the ecological condition's not so bad because it's the nutrients flushing. Are flushed out.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
My name is Kirsten Wasson, and I'm the research coordinator at the Elkhorn Slough Reserve, and I just have a few slides to follow up on the story of the effects of nutrient loading. So sticking with fish, we did, in addition to Brent's impressive work showing impaired beneficial uses offshore, even with fish as a function of Elkhorn Slough's water quality, we wanted to look up close at some representative sites around the estuary and see how they serve as fish habitat with varying water quality. And we did a simple caging experiment with summer interns in which we caged fish adjacent to water quality sonds, measuring the dissolved oxygen content. And we chose as an indicator species a very tolerant species, so not at all a canary in a coal mine, but a very tolerant species, the staghorn sculpin. And what we found was that survival, shown here on the y-axis, was a direct function of how many hours a day the site was hypoxic. Hypoxia, number of hours per day that oxygen was below 5 milligrams per liter on the x-axis. So water quality is killing fish at Elkhorn Slough if you force them to endure these habitats. Now, normally fish would be able to swim away when they're not trapped in cages, but it's serving as an indication whether these real places around Elkhorn Slough are good fish habitat or not, and some of them are clearly not. And this is just something we also can use for public outreach because it makes it real to people. Look at the sad face of our summer intern holding that dead fish, that Elkhorn Slough's water quality is such that it kills fish, tolerant fish. We did the same study with oysters, put oysters in cages next to those sons. And oysters are extremely tolerant because they can shut down their valves and hold their breath basically all night long while the oxygen is low. So we found that the oysters didn't die, but they showed a clear sublethal response, in this case growth rate, during the three-month duration of the experiment decreased as a function of the lower dissolved oxygen. That's because they're holding their breath. They can't feed when they're clamped shut and holding their breath, so they feed less. So the water quality at some of these sites in Elkhorn Slough is not good for growing shellfish, another beneficial use of the estuary. And we've done some laboratory experiments that look at this more under more controlled conditions. Here are juvenile oysters grown under normal oxygen conditions versus juvenile oysters grown under low oxygen conditions. So I don't need to show you stats to see that difference. And this also further fits in with a picture of what limits oysters around the estuary. I published a paper on that topic a few years ago, and we sampled sites throughout the estuary and found that most of them had no oysters. Those are the sites shown in red throughout the estuary. And this includes many areas that, according to historical records, old leases, newspaper reports, Native American middens, sites that historically did have oysters present where they're absent now. And when we did an analysis of water quality as a function of oyster distribution, there was a significant correlation with oysters being absent from the sites with the highest nutrients, chlorophyll, and turbidity. And again, returning to this theme of tidal restriction that Andrea started us off with all those water control structures cutting off the interconnectedness of the system, we found that oysters were absent from 14 of 17 sites with water control structures. Keeping that historical perspective in mind as you look at current distributions is really important. And this map, the fully tidal areas today are shown in bright blue, and the historically tidal areas are shown in gray. So more than 50% of the historic estuary is behind water control structures. These are areas that formerly produced flatfish, produced oysters, that do not anymore because of the water quality impairments from that stagnation. Finally, I just want to mention our work in progress on salt marsh. As many of you know, Elkhorn Slough has seen extensive salt marsh loss over the past decades. And we're starting to examine the role that nutrient loading and eutrophication may be playing in that marsh loss. It appears that our marshes, what's killing them is that they're drowning, that they're inundated excessively. And we've been monitoring the exact elevation of our marshes very precisely, and it appears that our marshes are actually sinking. This is not helpful in the face of sea level rise, and it's a sign of things to get worse. And studies elsewhere in large-scale nutrient addition experiments have shown that you can have faster decomposition below ground. The microbes are fueled to have faster below-ground decomposition and less organic deposition by roots. The plants don't need to invest so much in roots if there's a lot of fertilizer. They put it into above-ground growth in nutrient-loaded areas versus control areas. And so there's in other regions, it appears that eutrophication can lead to marshes sinking. And we're exploring that now for Elkhorn Slough. We've already measured very high decomposition rates in our marshes relative to Morro Bay. We did a comparison. We've also been looking at the effects of macroalgal mats on the marsh, especially at the edge. We did a preliminary experiment last summer, doing a larger one this summer, looking at the marsh. Here's a comparison before we added algal mats and after, and you can just see visually that the marsh has been impaired by the macroalgal mats. And here's a graph showing the same thing. Here's biomass of marsh. If we add the wrack, there's a lot less marsh biomass than if we remove wrack. And this work is still in progress, so we'll report on the final findings in a year or two. But it looks like algal mats such as this one that the summer intern is standing on at the removal site may really contribute to loss of marsh at the edge. So we'll keep you posted. But loss of marsh sustainability in the face of sea level rise may be one of the biggest ecosystem effects of eutrophication. If we lose hundreds more acres of salt marsh, that's really a cornerstone of the whole function of the estuarine ecosystem. So to summarize what the three of us have told you, and what we want you to sort of think about. One is that we have a ton of water quality data, and we're glad to make those data available in whatever format is most useful for decision making, raw data analyses, summary reports, presentations to audiences. We're glad to see the data used. Our monitoring has revealed decades of high nutrient concentrations, what John showed you, with no general improvement over time. Though we have these nice case studies at a local scale where water quality improved as a result of upland and buffer restoration. And we've demonstrated significant negative effects of nutrient loading. We've shown you strong evidence for eutrophication problems, including diurnal hypoxia, extensive algal production, decreased eelgrass, oyster, and fish habitat. And our ongoing work suggests that eutrophication may also contribute significantly to the extensive marsh loss. We've shown you some pretty clear spatial patterns that the highest nutrient concentrations are found in the lower estuarine complex, but the worst eutrophication, getting back to Mr. Young's question, that the worst eutrophication is in the 50% of the estuary behind water control structures and in the upper Elkhorn Slough, which has the long residence time. So it's pretty clear that decreased nutrient loading would support greater ecological health of the estuary, and that the benefits, to end on something positive, would include increased production of eelgrass, fish, and oysters in the estuary. And all three of us can answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. So I would like to now open to questions from my colleagues. Yes, Mr. Johnston.
I have a couple of questions. First of all, the 50% of the estuary behind water control structures. I'm sure you've examined the possibility of removing some of those structures, and I guess there's some consequences to that, too, in terms of scouring and such. Can you just discuss that briefly?
Yeah, the majority of those water control structures still protect land uses by landowners in the area, in particular farming, and taking them out would flood land being used for other uses. So in the immediate short term, it doesn't seem possible in most places to do that. We think that though, even short of taking out the water control structures, the graph Brent showed of the relationship between hypoxia and tidal range, it seems like if you can get tidal range to even be 1 meter of the 2.5 that are normal for our system, you can remove a lot of the hypoxia problems. And so I don't really know what the most effective process towards working for better tide gate management so that some of these water control structures could just be opened a bit to increase flushing. I don't know what the best process would be, but I think that would really serve ecological health in the short term. As sea levels rise, there will be a whole new discussion of whether those dikes and berms and water control structures will be maintained or whether that battle will be given up at some point.
Okay, and second question. The nutrients in sediment, have you looked at, I know there's discussion where the problematic nutrient in Pinto Lake is phosphates. There's been discussion of trying to bind some of those phosphates in the sediment with bauxite they're talking about treating it with. Is there any potential for that? I don't really know if that's applicable if the sediments are nitrates. I mean, if the nutrients are nitrates.
yeah, I don't know if that's too applicable at the slough because there's so much sediment dynamics that are moving around, and it's more of a nitrate problem than a phosphate.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I have a quick a question, and it's basically a follow-up. When I was part of a group that came and visit you, and you gave us a very informative presentation, and as you indicate today again, when we're looking at the history of nitrate, you say, well, it's going to take years. So I pointed out to a study that was just released, I think, a month before the meeting, that was a scientific study that was just peer-reviewed and approved by the Academy of Science on nitrate aging tests. And so a couple of you sent me emails and asked for information on how to find that paper. So I gave you the link, and the study, as a refresher, was performed by the Marie Curie University in Paris and the Alberta University in Canada. And it showed aging going back to 75 years in different fields. So as a follow-up to that, at one of our most recent updates on and presentation on the groundwater cooperative monitoring program, a couple of the engineers who do perform the groundwater test, well test, I specifically asked them for what's the cost of performing the nitrate aging test. And he said, well, we got it down to less than $100 a sample, which surprised me. I thought that was very inexpensive. You know, I was expecting hundreds of dollars. And then the water aging test they do, they send that to Sandia Lab, and that's, you know, that gets into the $800 range. So I think that being able to pinpoint a little bit more of the legacy aspect of the aging, and this ties a little bit to Mr. Young's comment about historical data. If we would say, well, in this area, it looks like 50% of the nitrates are 50 years old, in this area 25 years old, I think it would help in a sense. You could almost overlay the map of showing historical data, current data, and it would give us an idea, as you pointed out rightfully. So if we turn off the spigot, it's still going to leach out for many, many years, but that perhaps would enrich the program. Now, I know all these things cost money, but since there's quite a bit of work done and cost effectiveness achieved by the folks doing the groundwater monitoring, it may be of value for, you know, both of you to communicate and maybe get some information from them on the technology they use and how they were able to get the cost down to that level.
Another angle on that we're interested in is in examining the hypothesis of the nitrates being current versus historical. We have this time series of monthly nitrate data, and if we could work with partners to look at fertilizer sales, land uses, and take out the effects of weather from the data, we could look for correlations. And if there's a very strong correlation between years that there's higher nitrate sales and years that there's higher nitrate concentrations measured, then it would look like the current use is dominating the signal. But if there's a poor correlation, then that's not the case. And that's something we certainly could do with our existing data and some help from people on the land use agricultural side to inform that analysis. And we'd like to do that.
Thank you. Mr. Young.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the presentation. Kind of following up to what Mr. Johnston was asking about, my question that I've added on my yellow sheet here, there were two of them for follow-up. One is, so what factors, conditions could we do that would improve water quality and the status of beneficial uses? So one of them is clearly these flood control devices and how much they could be modified in terms of how they operate. Okay, so that's allowing more tidal exchange. How about the nutrient loading? How much do we have to kind of decrease that loading before we start to see a beneficial effect, you know, on beneficial uses? That's one question. And then kind of a parallel question goes to staff. Didn't we just, have we done a TMDL for this area on nutrients?
Yes.
I mean, do we have something in place?
Do we have a
TMDL?
Yeah, Larry Harlan again. We did a TMDL for the Lower Santa Maria River watershed, Lower Salinas River watershed, and I don't believe it incorporated the slough. It was just portions of the old Salinas River Canal and Salinas River Reclamation Canal and other Salinas area water bodies, but it didn't address the Elkhorn Slough.
Can you put your map up, if you could, so that I can get an idea then of what we have TMDL'd and what we haven't? Okay.
Here.
So could you show us then, is it just the lower part of this?
Yes, it's the lower part all the way up into the harbor.
Okay.
And I think...
And going east, how far?
All the way, not including the slough, but east all the way through. I'm trying to think of it. I think it may have included more coho. I don't recall. I didn't do the project.
So we haven't done any of the Elkhorn slough?
Correct.
Are we going to?
I don't have the schedule for that, but I'm sure we would at some point.
It's listed.
We have to do it at some point in time. Okay.
Do you know if it's, Gray might know more about the...
Gray Hayes, Elkhorn Slough. In the latest schedule of TMDLs to establish, 2021 is when the TMDLs are supposed to be adopted for the Elkhorn Slough for five different impairments.
How old am I going to be?
There's a very, very long list.
If I may add something, there's research that's being conducted by the Southern California Coastal Water Research Group down in Orange County, and they are looking at some sort of indicators and a whole suite of parameters that can be looked at to help assess attainment of beneficial uses, the impacts and of loading of nutrients as well. So that guidance we expect to come up in the near future. I don't know exactly when, though.
Okay. And when we talk of sediments, you mentioned that the nitrogen is bound up in sediment. How deep is that bound up?
It's clear.
Do we know?
I don't know exactly how deep.
We don't?
No.
Okay. And then something else that would be helpful, kind of an overlay of the water quality data to a map showing our designated beneficial uses and water quality standards would kind of tie your work into kind of what we do and blend the two. Mm-hmm. So it would just pop right out. We could see, here's, the areas of violated water quality standards. These are our designated beneficial uses, mm-hmm. at least for our agency. That would be helpful.
Yeah.
And then lastly, for the newbies that are falling asleep, with my long dissertation over here on the far side. This is the presentations that we heard that preceded the field trip before we went out and walked on the slough, if I'm not mistaken, both of them. So, okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Young. And it was not that long of a dissertation, so.
Okay. Looking at the guys over there are falling asleep. I can't even get their attention.
I think they're being... I think they're very attentive. Okay. they're doing their homework.
Okay, just wanted to make sure.
Could you raise the light? So, Mayor Delgado?
One question, and then a brief, very brief comment, not as long as former Chair Young's. Can you go back to your seagrass instability slide over the last century? Eelgrass slide. It looks like the decline was precipitous in the early days. That first eutrophication increase and the decrease of the eelgrass. Do you really think that was linked to the fertilizer increase?
Yeah. So we have no way of knowing. I mean, basically, what this comes from is is aerial photos that were taken. So we mapped out the aerial photos, and this is it's an indication of what we know. What causes declines in seagrasses, and there's two major ones: sedimentation and eutrophication. And so there's that, and that's the whole reason we put both of those up there as probably the what's causing the decline. So that decline in the 30s to the 50s is very similar to what's happening in Morro Bay right now, which you might all be aware of. Morro Bay's eelgrass beds have almost completely disappeared, and they don't know the reason either. And this is modern day times, and it's thought to be a combination of sedimentation and eutrophication. And so what we can tie this back to those events is kind of this period of resilience where we know that the estuary became flushed when they opened up the harbor mouth. And so we know that the water clarity probably improved, as well as kind of the stagnation of the water itself. And so we can't definitively say, oh, that was a water quality or a nutrient issue in the 30s and to the 50s. We can, in the later period, starting in that 70s decline, we have pretty good anecdotal evidence from previous researchers, as well as the nutrient situation in the estuary at that time, that was probably a eutrophication event that was driving the declines.
And following on what you just said, why in the late 60s to mid 70s was there a decline?
So that's another thing. So it was more that decline was more than likely due to nutrient loading causing eutrophication. And so what happens with the seagrasses is when you get nutrient loading, you get algal blooms that actually form on the leaves of the seagrass. So they're epiphytes. And if you get too many of these epiphytes, what it does is it just ends up just shading out the seagrass. It can't photosynthesize. And so we know that 1984 is that last point where it's at its lowest. That year, the sea otters moved back into the estuary. And this is kind of a different tangential story, but actually what we find is that the introduction of sea otters where they were able to counteract the effects of nutrient loading through this trophic cascade. And so basically sea otters moved into the estuary. They pretty much wiped out they wiped out the crabs in the system. And what these crabs do is they end up eating these little animals that grow on the seagrass that keep the seagrass clean. And so without the crabs in the system, because there's sea otters, these little tiny animals are free from predation, and they actually keep the seagrass clean. So it's interesting that you can have that much nutrient in the system, but just having an additional predator actually can flip the whole system.
Wow. Amazing.
So that's a paper we just published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Okay. The comment I want to make, thank you, Brent, was that yesterday we had I thought it was kind of an unfortunate comment by Kay Mercer about, you know, basically think more about humans than fish, you know. And you hear that a lot in various venues in life, this land use producer versus environment, and we're always trying to figure that out. But there's some value to me in this discussion that we had yesterday, or that I'm just bringing up, in the data that you showed today, because, you know, there are fisher people who are producers. There's fishing industries that are producing, and we, of course, use that food in various ways. So, you know, this was a good example that I'll try to remember, that the two are linked. You know, it's not about one or the other, and it's definitely, if you do a better job stewarding our resources, there's a higher quality of life and provision of food and jobs for people. And so I appreciated this for several reasons, but that's one of them. So thank you.
And shellfish production or oyster production would be another example.
Right. Thank you. Right.
And our resident historian of the Salinas Basin, Mr. Jeffrey. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I don't know if I'm a registered historian for this area, but I'm sure you've talked to Dr. Oliver about eelgrass, and he has a lot of information on eelgrass, and John and I are good friends, and he works with Moss Landing Harbor District considerably with eelgrass and other issues. This board has given, I don't know how many millions of dollars, Michael might be able to tell us how many million dollars that from PG&E settlement funds that have gone to the Elkhorn Slough and bought property around the Elkhorn Slough to reduce the sediment control and nitrate control from agricultural lands in that particular area. The other thing I wanted to ask you is, why didn't you talk about the scouring in the Elkhorn Slough? Because that ties in with sediment control, the nutrient problems, all that is all involved in that, and nobody of your group talked about the scouring and how we're going to stop that, because it's going to actually ruin the Elkhorn Slough.
We would love to have a longer presentation sometime and review all the threats to the estuary. I'd say we see hydrological alterations like water control structures and harbor jetties as one of the big threats. Invasive species are a huge threat to the estuary. In this presentation, we focused on the threats from water quality. But yes, there's numerous ways that humans have shaped Elkhorn Slough.
I realize you could take all afternoon and talk about everything that involves in the Elkhorn Slough and the estuary itself, but it's an interesting location, and a lot of history is there, and of not only the slough itself, but the workings around it, and I think Andrea, with her maps, showed how everything is interconnected in the valley and how that was all formed. So I want to thank all of you. I think you did a tremendous job on your presentations. You gave us just a little bit to kind of tickle our brains to make us think about other issues and so forth. But, I think, speaking for myself and probably Moss Landing Harbor District, that we welcome everything that you do, and we're there willing to help.
Thank you. Board members, any other question, comments? So I certainly echo my colleagues that very informative, and you brought some new material for those of us who have already gone through the presentation. I'd say keep up the good work, and let's make sure also we collect all the feedback. But thank you. We realize that there's a lot of effort, and it's a group effort to gather all this information. And
Mr. Chairman,
if you have any sometime additional questions, feel free to channel them through Mr. Harris. Like myself, if I find some other papers that may be of benefit, I will make sure to share it with the rest of you. Yes.
I just wanted to point out that all this work that you're doing is being used. You mentioned that if we want the data, it's available. We used your data extensively in the development of the ag order. We quoted it, we referenced it, and we presented it to the board multiple times. And so it is being used, and the board is making decisions based on it. So we appreciate it very much.
Thank you. That's why we're out there studying the slough, so it's great that you guys are using that. We really appreciate it.
Good comment, Mr. Thomas. Thank you. So
Thank you very much for the invitation to present today, and we'll look forward to engaging you in the future. And I think we have a meeting later this month with Chris Rose and his staff to talk about information needs and forming the TMDLs for Elkhorn Slough in the coming years. We're always open to requests, so, and I look forward to working with you on the tours coming up. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you again, all of you, for coming today. Appreciate. Our next item 14, Council Jar, any?
We do not have any closed session today.
All right. Mr. Harris?
Yes.
Any other item that you would like to bring up?
I have none at this time, Mr. Chair.
All right. So then I would like to adjourn our meeting, and our next scheduled board meeting will be on May 22nd and 23rd in San Luis Obispo. So thank you very much. Appreciate.
One modification. That may change relative to the environmental justice nexus and where we actually meet, and the tour may take us to a different location.
Well, we'll have to discuss that, because we want to make sure that we have a proper balance with other folks who come to regular meetings, too.
Yeah.
Thank you.